Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, if you're a parent, chances are you've asked yourself this question at 3 a.m. or any time of the day. Should I be worried? From fevers to funny rashes to sleepless nights and scary Google searches, knowing what's normal and what's not can feel overwhelming. Consultant paediatrician Dr. Niamh Lynch has distilled years of experience into a new book designed to calm the panic and boost your confidence. She joins me on the line now to talk about should I be worried? Niamh, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And why is this such a universal question? Is this one you hear over and over? Should I be worried?
I think it's part of parenting, really, isn't it? We all want the very best for our children, and we're very highly attuned to anything that might seem a bit wrong or a bit off, whether that's their health or whether it's any aspect of their life. And certainly I know that from as soon as I learned that I was pregnant with my first child, that question came into my head multiple times. And it's very interesting what I find as well, parenting nowadays, we tend not to have that sort of extended family around us that maybe we used to have 50, 60 years ago. And it can be a little bit of a lonely place as a parent, and you want to get sort of trustworthy advice without constantly having to ring your mum or your auntie or whatever. So a lot of us turn to the internet, and of course then you're only 3 clicks away from absolute disaster. So I think it's becoming an increasingly common question at the back of people's minds.
I know it is interesting when you think of how our ancestors would raise children, and you would have groups of generations together, and you would really lean on the elders in society who had, you know, raised children themselves, and, you know, who had noticed different ailments or, you know, how to treat them. And that's the kind of trust you'd have. And of course, there's lots of us who still very much lean, myself included, on our in-laws, on our parents to help us with our kids. But it would have been a lot more immediate. And what about that instinct that we carry ourselves? How do we have the confidence to believe in that instinct? Often we call it mother's instinct, but I think maybe we should call it parent or caregiver instinct, to know when there's something really wrong with the child we're with 24/7.
Well, I would always say that intuition is expertise. That's my kind of catchphrase. And, you know, as a doctor, I would have what people would say is clinical intuition about a patient. You know, I might look at them and go, oh, you know, I don't like the look of them. How do I know that things are not going right? Well, actually, that comes from years and years of experience and dealing with other children and observing. And parents do that with their own children all the time. So they live with them, you know, almost every hour of every day, and they become experts in their children's behaviors. So I often use the analogy of I can tell my child's mood by the way they walk around the house, you know. So that's my years of gathering data on how my children walk around the house, depending on what mood they're in. So, you know, if I hear them stomping down the stairs, I'm like, oh God, they're not in a good mood today. Is that instinct or is that knowledge based on years and years of gathering information about them? And I would say it's the latter. So I suppose to call it instinct or something that's intuitive actually minimizes it, because we are the experts in our own children. And that is something that is increasingly, I think, being recognized, thankfully, by the healthcare arena or area. And we certainly give parents expertise a lot more respect now than we would have done even 20 or 30 years ago.
And you mentioned your own kids there. Did you feel a shift in maybe your knowledge or your bandwidth or any change at all from the training you'd had and your work as a paediatrician and then becoming a parent yourself?
I thought it would be easy, you know, to become a parent with all of the knowledge that I had about child health. But of course, there's so much more to parenting than just their health. You know, there's their mental health, there's their development, there's, you know, feeding them, making sure they get enough sleep, clothing them, all of that stuff. There's so much. You kind of become a CEO of your family, you know, when your children arrive, because there's so much more to it than just their physical health. And I think we don't often recognize, or certainly when you're training as a doctor, you know, you're taught to recognize the sort of the physical stuff and how to sort things out practically, but you can't forget, you know, the emotions and the love and the care that come with every child packaged up in their parents. And I suppose once I became a parent myself, I suddenly understood where all these other parents were coming from. You know, when something's wrong with your child, the anxiety of it, the fear of it is just overwhelming. And I guess I got another insight into how parents might feel after becoming a parent myself. So I wouldn't say that pediatricians who don't have children are not brilliant pediatricians, because that's not true, but it probably gave me a little bit of extra depth in terms of my own clinical practice.
So talk to me about your social media and really upping what you were sharing on Instagram and other areas during the pandemic and how that first came about.
Yeah, so I was on what was then Twitter, which is now X, which I'm obviously not on anymore. And, you know, advocating for children, for health. I remember they weren't able to get shoes. Do you remember that? children weren't able to have their feet fitted for shoes. And I was meeting kids with infections on their feet because they were getting blisters because they were wearing Wellingtons. And, you know, it was a disaster, really. So I was trying to advocate from that point of view. But you'd always get kicked back. There'd always be the kind of, you know, the sort of strange people in the comments and all that. And then a friend of mine said, you know, Instagram is a much friendlier space if you want to communicate with parents, and, you know, you might find it good or a good outlet and, you know, a way to sort of advocate in a gentler space. And so I just started a page, and immediately I was inundated with parents going, you know, I can't get an appointment with my GP, or I can't get an appointment with public health nurse. I'm so worried about the shape of my child's head, or they're not sitting yet. Is this normal? Isn't it, you know, should I be worried, literally? And so I started doing kind of series on, you know, what just sort of developmental milestones to look out for, what red flags of illness to look out for. And the following just kind of exploded. Like within about 2 weeks, I had loads of, like, thousands of followers, and I couldn't believe it, and I was kind of mortified and kind of intrigued. And I just started then making posts, and then sort of doing talking to camera, which I was so embarrassed about, and so I felt it was so cringy, but I got over myself and just kept going, and people seemed to really like it, so I just kept doing it. It's become kind of part of my week now, where I'd make some videos and put them up online, and it's just worked into my daily routine.
Yeah, I mean, you've got over 300,000 followers now across the various platforms, TikTok now and Instagram, and it is really helpful. And I know people in the medical profession have to be really careful. All say, I can't give medical advice. You can't really come back in the DMs and give individual advice, obviously, without seeing the patient or the child in question. But to be able to do, as you say, a quick post that can give that information to that person and to many, so that knowledge is power, so that they know when to be worried, when to ask for help, what to look out for and what questions to ask. Like, it is a very powerful medium.
It is, yes, but I suppose it's transient, like everything on social media. You know, what I have up there, once I put it up there, it's not mine anymore, really. You know, Mark Zuckerberg could shut the whole thing down in the morning if he wanted to. And that's really why I wanted to have a book as well. So it's a tangible thing, you know, it's something that it's not going to disappear. You know, if it's on your shelf, it's there. And that, to me, that's sort of an important milestone in terms of sharing information, because you know, the internet has changed a lot, especially with AI now. Like, anything that I put up could be taken and manipulated into something different. Do you know what I mean? And that actually, that does worry me. So at least if there's something tangible, you know, you can't manipulate the printed word as such. To me, that's kind of a reassurance nearly, that I actually have put it all together now, and the parents can access it and know, like, this is legit. This has been double and triple checked. It's facts. So that's what was part of my motivation for doing the book.
And it is so, so detailed. I have it in front of me now, a no panic guide to your child's health. You go from, you know, 0 to 5 on into the early years, literally month by month, and then all the different things that might come up, you know, from developmental differences, as you touched on, hospital visits, teething and teeth. So how did you decide what to put in and what not? And what was the process like for you?
So I talked to my friends actually, and I talked to people who had young kids, and I asked them, you know, what would they find valuable. And then I had a look at my Instagram page, and you know, the posts that were sort of successful, and you know, that had a lot of engagement, and kind of made out a framework then for that. And then I went back then to, you know, into my own head, I suppose, and remembering the sort of emotions of what it was like to be a mom in the early days, and you know, kind of what I would have appreciated back then. And I remembered as well the sort of the more austere books that were around, let's say, when I was a new mom. And I just thought people need something a bit more friendly and a bit more accessible. So then I started laying out the chapters, and I got completely engrossed, like in the first few months, you know, of life. I got so engrossed in it that I missed my deadline for submission. They were like, where's the book, Liam? And I was like, oh god, I'm still working on like months 0 to 2, you know. So I put a lot of time and effort into the very start of the book, just so that it would all hang from that and follow from that.
And I do think that is perhaps the scariest time, because, you know, we mentioned the instincts and everything that begin to kick in when a baby comes into your care. And I remember a friend of mine saying, it's so funny how you view the world differently. Plug sockets all of a sudden look like potential death traps. You know, you survey for danger at all times. And this urge to keep this child safe and well overrides everything else. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know it's one of the biggest fears, is when a child begins to run a fever, I think that's when parents can really begin to panic. So, you know, when is it time to just perhaps administer, you know, paracetamol or, you know, a Calpol or a Nurofen? And when do you rush to A&E? Because everybody worries about reading it wrong and not getting to the hospital on time. And then I think people also worry about being seen as a terrified, overdramatic new parent. So what's your advice in navigating all of that when it comes to a fever?
So the hard line is that any baby under the age of 3 months with a fever needs to be medically reviewed. And that's because their immune system is immature, so they can become easily overwhelmed by both viral and bacterial infections. So any baby under the age of 3 months with a fever needs to be medically reviewed. And it doesn't matter what time of the day or night that is, you need to get them checked out. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is like sort of fever red flags. So once the baby gets to over 3 months, of course, then you're kind of bricking it, because you know you're so conditioned to go and get help, and you know it's very hard to be confident then to manage the fever at home once they're a bit older. But you're looking out for other things as well. So fever is just a symptom of an illness, it's not the illness itself. And you're looking for signs of lethargy, poor feeding, decreased wet nappies, excessive vomiting, any sign of a rash, extreme irritability. All of those kind of things would be red flags and signs that you should get help. If your baby's working very hard to breathe, for example, is another thing. And then another sort of red flag that's sort of more long term is if the fever goes on for 5 days or more, then it's more likely to be bacterial than viral and will probably need an antibiotic. So those are the kind of things you're going to start looking out for. And again, the first fever is going to be intimidating and nerve-wracking. But then, unfortunately, your child is going to have, on average, one infection every month for the first 3 or 4 years of their life anyway, as they encounter various bugs for the first time. So you will, unfortunately, you will actually get quite used to fevers. But it's just knowing how to handle them and knowing when you need to go and get help. And that's quite empowering. Then you say, OK, well, look, these are the red lines, and if I'm starting the red flags, and if I'm starting to see them, at least I know that I can go and advocate for my child.
Yeah, because sometimes you can have conflicting advice perhaps on Google or something that will scare you into taking perhaps the wrong action, or just panicking at a time when you really need to stay calm. You have a great no-nonsense way about you, Niamh, that I really liked looking through some of your videos. The one I watched last night, or one of them, was about visitors coming to a house with a new baby. And that's been quite topical lately. Something I think in this generation that perhaps we didn't consider saying was, you know, please don't hold the newborn, or please don't kiss the newborn. And obviously that can upset certain camps. But I loved what you said. You sort of said, look, visitors can come in if they're going to help you, if they're going to make you a cup of tea or watch the baby while you have a shower. But if they're going to come in and sit and expect to be handed those things, we'll keep those kind of visitors away. I really like that style that you have. How do you make sure the language that you use really empowers parents? It's medical jargon that they can understand, but also that you're, you know, not getting lambasted in the DMs as well.
That's a fine line. I think I've learned that over the last 4 years. You know, you get it wrong sometimes too. Like I've posted videos that have upset people where I obviously haven't meant to, or frightened people, and I obviously never meant to do that either. Sometimes sharing a very blunt fact can actually terrify people, and that's obviously never been my intention. So I would take that as, you know, if the comments are annoyed and angry, I'd sit back and I go, oh God, maybe I could have done that a bit differently or a bit better. And you learn then for the next time, you know. So, but I suppose the visitor thing, it's something parents are kind of told now in antenatal classes and stuff like that. No visitors, you know, nobody should be coming into the house. And that's very much like my kids at school, you know, where they're being told you have to do your homework, you have to do hours and hours of study. That's basically for the kids who are only half paying attention and who mightn't stick to the rules, whereas the people who are very sort of rule following will follow it to the letter. And when some parents then will hear that and say, I can't have any visitors because I've been told I shouldn't have any visitors. And that could be harmful as well. It's very important for parental mental health that they can have contact with the outside world. And the intention isn't just for people to hermetically seal themselves away in the first, you know, 5 or 6 weeks of a baby's life. That's not healthy either. So it's all about getting the right balance.
Yeah, 100%. Well, look, as they say, it takes a village, and I recommend you get Dr. Niamh Lynch in yours. You can follow her on Instagram at Dr. Niamh_Lynch. The book, Should I Be Worried? A No Panic Guide to Your Child's Health. Dr. Niamh Lynch, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.